I'd like now to welcome Baker Morrow. He is a landscape architect. He's founding director of the Landscape Architecture Program at the University of New Mexico School of Architecture and Planning. He's editor and translator of The South American Expeditions, 1540 to 1545, of Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca. And tonight he will be giving a lecture. It's a free event at 6 o'clock called Whatever Happened to Cabeza de Vaca. It's at the James A. Little Theater on the campus of the New Mexico School for the Deaf, and it's sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Very happy to be here.
It's great to have you. Now let's talk for a moment about this character, Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca. Beautiful name. He was born in the late 1400s and had a really extraordinary life. Who was he?
He was born about 1488, we think, in a small town in Andalusia in southern Spain, Jerez de la Frontera. And he was the son of a caballero, a gentleman named Francisco de Vera. And his mother was Doña Teresa Cabeza de Vaca, and that's where he got his name. And I first became interested in him when I was a kid, and my dad and my granddad used to tell me stories about Cabeza de Vaca exploring the Southwest, the southwestern United States. And when I grew up and became a landscape architect, one of the things I realized I was interested in was the way the Southwest looked when the Europeans first came here, 400 years ago. And when I began studying Cabeza de Vaca and his incredible life, as you mentioned, he was born in Spain. He was the son of a noble family, but he was actually orphaned early and had to make his own way in life. He finally made it to the New World in 1527. I realized that the details of his life were just extraordinary. 500 years later, all we can do is stand back and look at him in wonderment. He was really one of the great explorers of history. A fascinating part of his background is that he actually was not the first conquistador in his family. His grandfather was the conqueror of the Canary Islands back in the 1470s. His granddad was a gentleman named Pedro de Vera, and Don Pedro got a royal commission from the Spanish king to conquer the Canary Islands. And we get a pretty good glimpse of how rough and tumble things were in the late Middle Ages in Spain when we look at how Don Pedro financed his conquest of Gran Canary Island. He had to go to his Moorish bankers, who were still in Spain at the time, and come up with the money to finance his entire expedition. He had to buy all the ships, furnish all the troops, come up with all of their equipment and all of their provisions, pay everybody, and the king certainly gave him a commission, but the king didn't have a nickel in it. And so what Don Pedro did was to take his own sons, Cabeza de Vaca's father and his uncle, and he pawned them to the Moorish bankers.
Oh, my goodness.
That's actually how the grandfather got the money to go forward with the conquest of the Canary Islands.
What does that mean, to pawn your children? Like, what happens to them?
The bankers gave Don Pedro the money, but the bankers also kept his sons until Don Pedro paid the money back.
And did, I mean, what did they have to do? Were they mucking stables? Were they slaves?
Well, we're not quite sure, but they were in the households of the Moorish bankers in Granada, in southern Spain, probably for 10 years or so, until Don Pedro earned the money back to be able to pay them back for their financing of the great expedition. But he was nevertheless successful. And Cabeza de Vaca, as a young man, Alvar Núñez, grew up on his grandfather's knee hearing all these tales of conquest. So I think he had in the back of his mind an idea as early as the early 1490s that there was something out in the Atlantic for him. If he went that direction, he was liable to make his fortune.
Now, being a conqueror was certainly not an easy thing to do. I mean, he went on these expeditions where huge numbers of people were killed. It also wasn't a job for really nice guys. He was one of the kind of nicer conquistadors, all things considered, but it was very rough business. You're basically conquering other people.
He had an interesting early professional life, Mary Charlotte. He enlisted in the Spanish armies in the about 1510 and went off to Italy, where he fought in lots of Italian wars. And when he came back to Spain, he went into service with the Dukes of Medina Sidonia in southern Spain and was in military service for a long time before 1527 came up and he had his first opportunity to come to the New World. But he was an unusual man from the very beginning. He was an orphan by about 1505. He had to make his own living. And his parents, we don't know why, had perished. They were gone, and he went to live with his aunt for some time before he joined the army. And so as a seasoned soldier with 15, 20 years worth of service, by the time he joined the Narvaez expedition to Florida, which was his first trip to the New World, he went to when he came to North America and ended up here in southern New Mexico, he had had almost four decades of life, 20 years of service in the army. And he, from the very beginning, was fascinated with people. You can tell from reading his North American memoir, the Relacion, that he's interested in all the tribes people that he comes across. He was a shipwrecked sailor, actually on the shores of Florida. That expedition met with nothing but disaster. It began with somewhere between 300 and 600 men. Pánfilo de Narváez, the gentleman who was the adelantado of that expedition, the leader of it, abandoned the men, and everybody died and was killed. There were four men left.
Out of 600.
And Cabeza de Vaca was such a sturdy guy that he and these three other companions became the first people to walk across North America. So they spent no time in conquest for 10 years. They were simply trying to go from Florida to Mexico to get back to the early Spanish settlements.
With no roads, no maps, and the tools you could carry with you.
No clothes.
How did they do it?
No canteens, no backpacks, no shoes.
No convenience stores.
Oh my goodness. They, at times, lived off cactus and cactus fruit in South Texas. At other times, they lived off acorns. That's all they ate. At other times, they lived off the ground-up seeds of grasses. On a really good day, they got to eat a squirrel, maybe a rabbit. In their progression from all the way from the coast of Florida to the west coast of Mexico, they began to put together quite a reputation as healers. And that's really what got them across the continent. And because Cabeza de Vaca was stripped of any vestige of European culture, he was literally naked with his companions, he came to have an appreciation of North American Indian culture that nobody else of the time could possibly have had. The great mystery about him is that after years of travel, he and his party went along the Gulf Coast of Mexico, and they finally hit the Rio Grande, where the Rio Grande goes into the Gulf of Mexico. All they had to do was continue on 200 or 300 more miles, and they would have hit the early Spanish settlements on the coast of Mexico, in the Gulf of Mexico, but instead of going south, they went north along the Rio Grande, and no one knows why. Cabeza de Vaca hung a right. He didn't hang a left.
Oh, my goodness.
And it took another 3 to 4 years to go up the Rio Grande, come through probably northern Chihuahua or southern New Mexico, cross the Sierra Madre, and then go down the desert valleys and through the parched flatlands of Sonora and Sinaloa until he hit the coast of the Sea of Cortez, the Gulf of California. The whole journey took 8 years. 600 men, reduced to 4, finally made it to Mexico City about 1533, 1534. So he spent no time in conquest. He was an explorer, and he was absolutely intrepid. When the explorers were naked and it was winter, they would scoop out places in the sand and build fires on both sides of where they were going to sleep, and they'd sleep in between the fires, and they'd have to get up every 2 or 3 hours and put more firewood on the blazes so that they could remain warm. That's how they lived. And by the time they showed up on the coast of Mexico, they had a following of several hundred Indians who were absolutely convinced that they were shaman.
Now, what was the nature of the healing that they did? They were considered shamans or healers. What do we know about that?
We do know that Cabeza de Vaca pulled an arrow out of the sternum of an Indian somewhere in Texas, dug it out. It was a stone arrow, pulled it out of the breastbone of this gentleman, probably cauterized it with a hot stone, cauterized the wound, or maybe a piece of metal, and the guy lived. And that was the beginning of his great reputation as a healer. But he was, for some reason, very adept at healing wounds, prescribing herbs and other treatments, and he just became quite famous. He healed people all across Texas and created this enormous following. Everybody fed him. The local people clothed him. He said when he got to what is now modern-day southern New Mexico that he ran into some southern Pueblo people in that part of the Rio Grande, and they had corn, beans, squash, and rabbit to eat, and it was the best meal he'd had in 5 years, the best series of meals.
We're talking to Baker Morrow about Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca. I mean, I imagine that part of his abilities to heal other people came from just learning to survive on such an incredibly arduous journey.
I think it did. I think he developed this enormous sense of empathy with the local people, and he couldn't stand to take anything from them without giving something back, so he was forever trading or exchanging. And when he got back to Mexico, the viceroy and the other Mexican officials, or Spanish officials in Mexico City, offered Cabeza de Vaca and his companions, Dorantes and Castillo, and they had a Moor from Morocco along with them, a gentleman named Estevanico. They offered these great travelers all kinds of positions, estates, considerations, and Cabeza de Vaca turned it all down. The explorers wrote a history of their trip, and Cabeza de Vaca, instead of staying in Mexico, at the insistence of the viceroy, said, well, I do need to go home and make a report to the king, who was Charles I of Spain, Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire, actually the ruler of 75% of Europe. So he went home to make his report, and he asked the king, this is about 1537, he asked the king for a new job, and the king was astonished. He said, you want to go back to the New World? And Cabeza de Vaca said, yes, I would like Narvaez's old job. Let me lead another expedition to Florida. And the king said, I'm sorry, I've just appointed another new adelantado, a new governor, to go there. His name is De Soto. At some point in the future, people will name a car after this guy. So we don't have any openings, but stick around. Maybe something will come up. And in the meantime, the governor of the La Plata province in southern South America was sailing back to make a report to the king on his own new province, and he died in the middle of the ocean. So Carlos never paid very much attention to the New World. He was getting a fortune in gold and silver from the New World, but he was always more interested in his German provinces. So he asked one of his courtiers, who was that fellow who was here 6 months ago or so? That's Cabeza de Vaca, sir. Have him come in. So Cabeza de Vaca did have another audience with the king. The king said, the governor in La Plata has just died. I have an opening. Are you interested? And Cabeza de Vaca didn't bat an eye. He said, certainly. So that's how he became the governor, the second governor of the La Plata province. And the king said, here's the deal. You have to save the colonists who are in dire straits. You have to expand my territories, my territorial holdings. Please extend the reach of the Catholic Church. And if you make any money, I get a fifth of it. You pay all the expenses, all the ships, all the men, the same deal that his grandfather got. Is it a deal? And Cabeza de Vaca did say, yes, I'll agree to that. And so that's, in 1540, that's how he went to South America for his second act.
So tell us about his second act. This is the lesser known part of his life.
One of the interesting things to me is that we have only discovered in the last 10 years or so that Cabeza de Vaca was married. His wife's name is Maria Marmolejo. She was from a converso family in southern Spain, converted Jews. Apparently, she and her family were fairly well off because she helped him, assisted him in all of his New World exploits. So when Cabeza de Vaca set sail from the docks of Seville in 1540, he had five or six ships, he had 300 or 400 men, he had 100 horses, all the supplies necessary to save the new colony. It cost him something like 8,000 ducats, which is a king's ransom. It's $30-40 million in modern funds. And off he went. So he landed on the coast of Brazil on Santa Catalina Island. He immediately sent an expedition to Buenos Aires, off to the south, to see if anybody was left there. But for some inexplicable reason, the Spaniards had gone 1,000 miles up the Paraná River, and they were now in the new colony of Paraguay in the middle of South America. So he launched two expeditions, actually. He and his men, the primary force, marched cross-country from Santa Catalina Island, 700 or 800 miles to the interior, through the jungles, across the forests, over mountains, up and down rivers and valleys. And then he, as I mentioned, had also sent a rescue party down to Buenos Aires. So when he arrived in Asunción, he was able to save the colony. He immediately achieved his first goal.
What does that mean, to save the colony?
They were surrounded by many, many tribespeople who were not happy with their presence. The Guaycurúes, the Guarani Indians, the Guajarapos, the Ipaneses. There are probably 30 tribes that Cabeza de Vaca mentions that he came across in this part of South America. The colonists were continually skirmishing with the local people. They couldn't buy food. They couldn't buy any kind of clothing. They couldn't buy supplies. And it was very difficult for them to sail all the way down the Paraná River to the Rio de la Plata and back to Spain and then come back with supplies. So the new supplies that Cabeza de Vaca brought in gave them considerable amount of relief to begin with, but he immediately saw that the primary problem was creating some sort of peace between the local Indians and the Spanish colonists, so he began doing that as well.
How did he do that?
Through a series of treaties. The Spaniards in the 1500s are very legalistic. They're very much interested in legal compacts with local people, and so Cabeza de Vaca insisted that all the people in the colony pay the Indians for everything, just as he had in North America. It was a new concept at that point. And by beginning to satisfy the demands of the local Indians for payment for their foodstuffs and their clothing and their canoes, all their other supplies, he immediately calmed down the local situation. And the Indians were fighting among each other, tribe with tribe as well, and so he set out systematically to create a peaceful context for the new colony.
Which probably came to some extent from the sympathy that he'd gained from Indian tribes in North America when he was walking across the country, or the continent.
Came completely from that. Cabeza de Vaca went out of his way to find interpreters who could speak the local language as well as Spanish, and brought local officials, Indian officials, in to chat with him and create these peace treaties on all fronts. So it was his insistence on payment that really set him apart from many of the other colonists of the time.
How did that attitude of his go over with the other Spaniards?
Not too well. He had to deal with a number of problems. The allocation of land throughout Paraguay was up in the air at that point, and Cabeza de Vaca wanted his colonists to pay for the land that they'd actually acquired from the Indians. So he kept insisting on it. He enlisted the help of the church, which was also reluctant to get involved in something that was as systematic as ongoing payments to the Indians for goods and services. But he insisted on it, and so for a number of years, a peaceful condition began to spread around Paraguay because of his imposition of a new legal system, the Spanish legal system that he said applied in Spain, and it should also apply in this new society that he saw being built in Paraguay, in which the Indians would be equal partners with the Europeans.
Now, did that last beyond the time that he was actually in charge?
He, I think, was at heart always an explorer. And he's one of the great explorers of history, Mary Charlotte. He really is on a par with Sir Richard Burton in the 19th century or Marco Polo in the 13th century. What he's really itching to do is get everything settled as governor so that he can continue exploring the middle of South America. And he had an idea in the back of his mind that he would expand his colony to connect with the new colony in Peru that the Pizarro brothers had just created. It was 10 years old at the time. So he wanted to explore to the north and to the west, and he did his utmost to create a prosperous situation in Paraguay itself so that he could continue exploring. And you can see in the 84 chapters in this book where his expeditions go. That's why it's called the South American Expeditions. He will calm down some unrest or rebuild Asunción from a colossal fire that almost wiped out the town, or resupply the colonists down and the ones who were left in Buenos Aires. And then he gets those kinds of situations calmed down and he wants to go off exploring. So that's what he does. And it ultimately, his policies of fair treatment of the Indians led to an enormous mutiny. His lieutenant governor was a gentleman named Domingo Martinez de Irala. He's very resentful that Cabeza, he was the lieutenant governor of the province, he was very resentful that Cabeza de Vaca had shown up. And so the tale of the South American expeditions, to a large extent, is the tale of the great ongoing antagonism between these two towering figures of the early colonial settlements of La Plata.
We're talking to Baker Morrow about Álvaro Núñez Cabeza de Vaca. So how did it all come out? What happened to Cabeza de Vaca as he got older toward the end of his life?
Well, there's a distinct difference in the way South America is explored by Cabeza de Vaca and the way he walked across North America. North America is much drier on the whole than the part of South America that he went to in the second half of his life or second half of his public service. So he did most of his exploring in Paraguay on little ships that he himself built. They're called brigantines, launches. And he had very good ship's carpenters and ingots of iron. That's all he needed because he traded for canvas to create sails, cotton cloth, and he traded for rope with the local Indians. And so he built himself, literally in the middle of the South American wilderness, a whole fleet of small ships and began to sail them up and down the rivers to do his explorations. He had three ways of moving. The explorers liked to move with a breeze, but often the breeze would fail on the Paraná or the Pilcomayo or some of the other large rivers. So the men would pull out their oars and they would row upstream. And when that failed, when they couldn't row because the draft of the river was too shallow or the current too swift, they had tow lines, and they pulled these ships from the shoreline. Parties of men would go onto the shore and pull them. In some cases, they even dismantled the ships and lifted them up over rapids. Because of his insatiable exploration, he actually was the discoverer of Iguazu Falls, the biggest waterfall in South America. So there are statues to Cabeza de Vaca and his exploration there to this day. He went up to the head of the Paraná River, which is in the middle of South America, at the western side of Brazil, and began exploring in this extremely wet, swampy wilderness and experienced a big mutiny. This Lieutenant Governor Irala, who had previously shot him through the face with a couple of harquebus shots. Cabeza de Vaca was a little irked by it. He said,
you think?
He said, this was very irritating, but that's all he ever says because he's essentially unkillable. Irala mounts this mutiny, throws Cabeza de Vaca in jail, holds him a prisoner, and takes over the colony again. And mutiny then, as mutiny now, especially in the armed service of the civil authority, the military authority, the king, is a dire crime. So Irala wanted to take over the colony, but he conspired to create a whole series of charges against Cabeza de Vaca and eventually shipped him back to Spain in chains to be tried by the Council of the Indies for malfeasance. So Cabeza de Vaca's policies of fairness in South America and all of his really fantastic explorations ended up with him back in Spain. And when you read biographies of him to this day, especially 20th century biographies, what you'll find is this romantic interpretation of how Cabeza de Vaca went into his old age, derided by the king, discarded by the court, impoverished, exiled to Africa, and that's all nonsense.
What happened?
That never happened. He went home. The mutineers had a change of heart. They tried to poison him with arsenic. Luckily, he had a little amulet around his neck that had a secret compartment that had the powdered horn of a unicorn in it, which he used as an antidote.
Yes, those South American unicorns.
Right. He had it, and so he counteracted the poisoning, and the lieutenant governor's men made it to the king's court at about the same time. They filed charges, but he wasn't going to take anything sitting down. He filed counter charges. So there are four lawsuits after he gets back to Spain, and they take about 10 years to resolve. He wins. He's actually reinstated as governor. But the Council of the Indies said to him, if you go back to Paraguay, are you thinking about punishing all these fellows? And he said, what do you think? And they said, we think you'll be a disruptive influence. So we're reestablishing your authority, but please stay here in Spain. So Cabeza de Vaca ended up as a lobbyist in the court of the king for his old hometown, Jerez, and we think he died of old age at home in bed after all these phenomenal travels.
Amazing, so, amazing life. And it really, I mean, it's such a parable of the conflict between peace and conquest, and conquest seems to win in the long run.
Maybe it does, but Cabeza de Vaca's religious counterpart was Father de las Casas, and he was one of the most vigorous defenders of the Indians in the 16th century from the religious side. Cabeza de Vaca really becomes the great secular champion of the Indians and states in no uncertain terms how he thinks a new Spanish society should be established in the New World and that it should be a fair society that includes everybody, the conquered and the conquerors as well. So for a man of his time, 500 years ago, I'm just not sure it gets more progressive.
Baker Morrow is a landscape architect. He is at the UNM School of Architecture and Planning. He's editor and translator of the South American Expeditions 1540 to 1545 of Álvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca. And tonight at 6 o'clock, he's giving a free talk titled Whatever Happened to Cabeza de Vaca at the James A. Little Theater on the campus of the New Mexico School for the Deaf. It's sponsored by the School for Advanced Research. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Great pleasure.